This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. So this week, David Cameron has been hauled in front of MPs to answer for the Queensill scandal. James, we've also seen some texts that have been released, so can you talk us through what's been happening this week?
So earlier in the week, as part of his Treasury Select Committee inquiry, David Cameron put out the kind of 56 messages he had sent to various government ministers and officials about Greensill Capital. And I don't think they were messages that Cameron ever expected to become public. You know, he signs off one to Tom Scholar, the permanent secretary of the Treasury, Love DC, talks about meeting for an elbow bump or a foot tap at some point soon. And so he's now before the Treasury Select Committee today. Cameron calls it in his introductory statement a kind of painful day. I mean, the difficulty with David Cameron is that while he technically hasn't broken any rules, part of the reason why he hasn't broken any rules is the rules that were passed when he was Prime Minister did not have that much bite to them. And I think the other problem is that as Prime Minister and as leader of the opposition, Cameron himself used to warn about lobbying as the next big scandal. So this is clearly an awkward, difficult situation for him. He also obviously doesn't want to say how much he was paid. He's just referring to a kind of big and generous pay package that he had with Greensill. And I think this is what's difficult. Kind of Cameron wants to argue, look, he wasn't just doing this for his own personal financial interest, but because he thought the scheme was a good scheme. I mean, the problem is there are sufficient questions about Greensill Capital that people are saying, well why didn't you, you're a former Treasury Special Advisor, why didn't you ask more questions about the business model? I mean, this is difficult for him. I think the one thing where Cameron has a fair point is we have a structural problem now, which is that politicians do these big jobs younger and younger. And he wasn't even 50 when he left office. And I think he clearly was going to want to do something else with his life. And given the circumstances in which he left office, the international organisation route, you know, wasn't exactly open to him. And should there be a better system to provide people with support and advice? But I also think it's a fair point to say that if he'd applied some common sense, he would have realised that people were going to reply to messages from a former Prime Minister. And he should have been more judicious about how he contacted people and how often he did so.
Although tiny violin, he does have a lot of money even without the Greensill stuff, right? So he didn't have to go do that with his
post retirement. No, I think the psychological thing is people have a need to feel important. I think that, you know, you talk to people who were in government and out of government. This is one of the, you know, but it's this paradox when you're in government as a minister or, you know, and it's even obviously more intense if you're a prime minister, you get driven mad by the fact your phone is constantly going off, beep, beep, beep. But then when you leave and suddenly your phone goes quiet, you find that equally maddening somehow. You lived off that sense of adrenaline, importance, you were taking big decisions, and then that goes away and that leaves you fairly bereft. I mean, I think this is kind of, you know, I mean, I think there's a limit to how much tennis David Cameron can play. And this, you know, I think this, and I think
shed building.
No, sure. I think it's a look, I'm not defending the way he behaved in the circumstance, but I think the idea is he's going to want to do something substantial, you know, and I think he clearly picked the wrong firm to go and have this close role with. And it's an odd thing because I, you know, there are lots of things we can think about the Cameron era that is interesting. I wouldn't have put down supply chain finance as one of them.
Katie, is there anything game-changing that came out from today's Treasury Select Committee hearing? And also, do we need to institute some kind of rehab for ex-prime ministers?
So I don't think anything game-changing so far in terms of the evidence. I think it's just a further embarrassment for David Cameron in terms of the whole affair so far. And we've seen the government get brought into it in terms of Rishi Sunak, in terms of questions about Matt Hancock going for a drink with David Cameron. But I think so far the evidence is one which is more painful for David Cameron than current ministers. It's interesting, James talks about how, you know, he didn't want to give away his salary for Greensill, but he did say, you know, it's a generous amount of far more than when I was Prime Minister. Mm. And I think one of the more interesting things is I think what does it tell us about, do we need new rules? Do we need to have more thought about what a prime minister does after they finish in their role? Now, again, you say small violin. I don't think people will think this is the burning injustice of our time. But I think there is a question if we look at, across the board. Actually, prime ministers who generally seem to be less successful, so figures such as Gordon Brown and Theresa May, I think have come out of the Green Seal saga and the lobbying row better than figures such as David Cameron or Tony Blair, because now casting a light at the various decisions people made. Now, I think Theresa May is an interesting example because she has stayed in the Commons and received lots of compliments and, you know, applause as a result. But she also is making a lot of money in speaking engagements. If you look at the register of interest, you know, really to a degree raking it in. And I wonder, I suppose going forward, if there's going to be more scrutiny over the roles people take post-government, and it, whether that is in terms of a role like David Cameron went for, or in the case of Tony Blair advising various foreign governments, some who are seen more dubious than others, is it going to become back in fashion for a younger prime minister to stay in the Commons and do side work? Now, I think in terms of Boris Johnson, it'll be interesting to see what he chooses to do, because we know of, and perhaps why it's quite potent, of all the prime ministers when they are ending the term, Boris Johnson does need to earn quite a lot of money. When it comes to his financial situation, which is often in the news, you will hear Tory MPs now say, well, can he afford to go for a second term? No, most people think he will. But I think what will help Boris Johnson is the fact that he actually has a means, or, you know, a way to earn money outside of government, which is A, of course, speeches, but two, the fact that he is a writer, various books, you know, a well-paid column someone can only ever dream of, in terms of that which he could return to. But I do think this question of a prime minister's career after they finish office is actually going to rise in potency for that reason.
I think Katie is right in that Boris Johnson has an easy solution to the post-prime ministerial earning business. First of all, if people pay £40,000 to hear a Theresa May after dinner speech, I think Boris Johnson can be confident of kind of getting more than that. Secondly, he'll publish his Shakespeare book, he'll crank out a few more books, they'll sell well, he'll do TV, as Katie said, he'll write a column. You can see how it all adds up fairly quickly. I think in some ways David Cameron was going back to the private sector job which he'd done before, which was being a kind of PR government affairs person for Carlton Television. I think this is problematic. I think on the points about prime ministers, you know, I do think we benefit when prime ministers stay engaged in public life. You know, the Commons, Theresa May's presence is obviously, whether you agree with her on every issue or not, it clearly is good to have a former prime minister in the Commons. And Gordon Brown's stuff at the moment, where again, whether you agree with it or not on the Constitution, you know, this is clearly stuff that he has thought about it, and it enriches public debate. And I think one of the striking things is that Tony Blair, after years in which making money seems to be the primary priority, is clearly now trying to get back into public debate. You know, he's got a big essay in another weekly opinion magazine this week on what the Labour Party needs to do. But I think the kind of question for Cameron is, you know, what is the issue on which he comes back into public life? And I think this episode has undoubtedly made that kind of re-entry into the national debate harder for him.
And Katie, it's only been a few days since the Prime Minister said that we are on track for releasing the lockdown on June 21st, but today headlines seem to think slightly differently as there are new concerns about the Indian variant.
Yes, I mean, the Prime Minister is still insisting we are on track. So speaking today, he said, at the moment, I can see nothing that dissuades me from thinking we will be able to go ahead on Monday and indeed on June 21 everywhere. But he also said that the Indian variant is a variant of concern. We are anxious about it. And there are a range of things we can do. Now, the Indian variant is an awkward issue for this government. I think that before we go into what they're going to do about it, it's worth pointing out that the variant is now dominant in a few areas. It's not widespread, but it is growing in dominance in those areas, which is creating concern because there is a sense that it spreads even quicker, perhaps, than the Kent variant. But there is nothing so far to suggest that it evades vaccines. And I think that there are probably greater concerns about the South African variant in terms of evading vaccines than the Indian variant. So, and obviously we still need to know more. It's not so much will this evade vaccines as to does this just mean you have a lot more cases? What does that mean for the roadmap? And obviously it's We need to learn more about the variant to be completely sure of all of this. But I think that's the dynamic here. Now, I think were the Indian variant to lead to a problem where the government had to reassess its plans, that is difficult for the Prime Minister because they took a long time to put India on the red list. When there were first reports about this, there was repeated calls for the government to do so, and they just waited, and it was generally seen to be that the reason they were doing this was because the Prime Minister was supposed to go to India on a government trip that he was very insistent he would go on, and they only cancelled that at the last minute. They cancelled the last minute. Very soon after that, it was put on the red list. And then we also just had a G7 meeting here, and you had an Indian delegation come, and there were two cases of COVID on that, which meant the whole team had to self-isolate, and they joined these calls remotely. So I think that for now, I think the general sense in government is this is not going to throw things off course, but they are having to look at it, and it is concerning the rate at which it's spreading in some areas. But I think if this were to escalate into a situation which throws things off track or at least brings things into question, I think the government is going to have to face several questions over why, if they are so concerned about it, they had a border policy which is more lax than actually Tory MPs, also cross-party MPs, at the time, suggested.
And James, despite what the Prime Minister is saying today, a Sage advisor has been quoted as saying that maybe we need to relook at the roadmap. And we have seen this film before where the Prime Minister kind of gets cold feet and U-turns on COVID. So do you think that June 21st is in question?
So I think two things. I think, first of all, Katie is completely right. This is going to ramp up the pressure about importing variants. People will say, oh, is this holiday easing coming on May the 17th, sensible, all of that stuff. I think the bigger thing that this points to is there's a kind of very crude way of working out what's going on, which is you take the vaccine take up and times it by the efficacy of the vaccine. And I think what you will see is that there is concern that some of the places where these new cases of the Indian variant appear to be spreading are places where vaccine take-up so far has been lower than the national average. And I think it's going to put a particular emphasis on that. I think the good news from some of these Indian variant hotspots are that among the older, more vaccinated population, you are not seeing a big uptick. It appears to be in younger, unvaccinated people where this is increasing. But I think what you will see is more and more nervousness about variants, because Boris Johnson is clearly moving towards a more big bang approach to June 21st than previously. He's already indicated that he hopes that the 1 meter rule will be able to go, so pubs and restaurants and things like that be able to operate at full capacity. We're also getting a sense that the Sun is saying today that masks like to go everywhere but public transport. So obviously the more comprehensive the opening up, the more concern there would be about variant. I mean, the worry about the Indian variant is that it is so transmissible that you would then become quite concerned about that equation of, vaccine take-up times vaccine efficacy and how many people that leaves vulnerable to it. But I do think I think Katie is right to stress that there are so far no signs that this escapes the vaccine. It does, and it does appear in those places where there are cases of it so far, that among the older, older vaccinated population, it is not spreading. It's not spreading in an alarming way.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And if you enjoyed this podcast, do rate and review us and tell a friend about it as well. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow.